Let's check in with golf legend John Daly.
I only spend on Moto, America's social casino. You know, I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. That's Daly. Moto Casino, hands down, has the best VIP experience. Take it from one high roller to another. Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces. If you're ready to go for the greens with me, grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Welcome in to the best in paranormal podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. I'm Tim Dennis on a Thursday. Got a good show for you. I know I say that every week, don't I? Or every day, but truly a good show for you today. You know, when we kind of relaunched Darkness Radio here, I told you I wanted to tell stories. And I wanted to tell stories and human interest stories of people. We have a good one today. We have John Russell on today. John is an internationally known professional psychic for almost a half century. He works with clients all over the world. I know you may say, well, Tim, that doesn't seem like an unusual story, but this is a truly unusual story. John's been a featured guest on many popular radio shows, recently filmed a TV pilot for the History Channel in which he psychically explores the assassination of President Abraham Lincoln. And his producer and director was a cynic, not a psych, not a skeptic, folks, a cynic. So we're going to get into that a little bit. He's also been an avid motorcyclist for over 50 years. One interest of mine, although I've always been, I'm going to use a bad word here. I've always been a chicken shit when it comes to bikes. I've always been an avid fan of bikes. So we may talk a little bit about that as well. When he's not chasing ghosts around the country on his motorcycle, John enjoys reading, painting, making photographs, gardening, target shooting, and fancies himself as a fair chess player. We're going to get into a lot of those interests. We're going to get into some amazing stories about ghosts and even aliens today on the program. Let's welcome to the Darkness on the Edge of Town Paranormal Radio Show, John Russell. John, how are you today?
I'm great, Tim. Thank you for having me. This is going to be a blast.
It is going to be a blast, my friend. I was excited to get you on the program because there's more here than just the average, ordinary garden variety psychic, if I can say that.
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree with that statement, yes.
Yeah, so I was excited to talk to you here. Let's start from the beginning, shall we? Everybody has a beginning to the origin story, so to speak. So let's start with your origin story. Tell me a little bit about John Russell as he comes up, so to speak, from childhood and the childhood beginnings. And when do you find out exactly you have a gift?
Well, I found out when I was about 5 years old. I was sound asleep in my bedroom one night, and my parents had put a nightlight in the hallway so that I could see if I had to get up, go to the bathroom or whatever, and my bedroom door was open. So I'm lying in bed, absolutely sound asleep, and a split second later I'm suddenly wide awake. No drowsiness, no grogginess, and I couldn't figure that out. I thought, well, this is really strange. I thought, well, maybe there was a noise outside that woke me up or something. So I just laid there in bed real still and listened a little bit. Didn't hear anything. So I raised up on my elbows to look around the bedroom, look outside through the windows, and I looked around, looked down the hallway, and there was this elderly black gentleman peering around the door frame, staring at me down the hallway. And I screamed bloody murder because my family was white. We didn't have anyone black living with us. I don't think we even knew anybody black at the time. Those were those days and times. And so I presumed an intruder had broken in. Mm-hmm. And when I screamed, he walked around the door frame into the hallway and began to walk toward my bedroom, walk toward me. And locked eyes with me the whole time, never looked away. His look wasn't menacing, but it was almost kind of abused. Like, why is this kid screaming his head off? Didn't he realize I'm trying to help him here? And he wasn't misty. He wasn't transparent. He wasn't translucent. He was every bit as solid as you or I. Huh. And I can tell you the clothes he had on, he had, and I knew he was elderly because he had close-cropped white hair and a white mustache. And he had a red flannel shirt on, and khaki pants, black dress shoes, and a black belt. And I'll remember that till the day I die. And I screamed bloody murder again. By that time, lights were coming on. My parents were coming running. And he began to disappear. And he started from the feet, went up to his head, and vanished. And my parents came in and, of course, tried to tell me that I'd had a nightmare. Oh, you probably saw something on TV and you're having a nightmare. It scares you or whatever. And I said, no, there's somebody in this house. Even though I'd just seen him disappear, I said, there's somebody in this house. And I was so convincing that my father actually went through the entire house, checked all the doors and windows to make sure they were locked, and they were. He actually checked under the beds and in the closets. And so they're trying to console me, trying to get me back to sleep. And this was super hard because I'm like, where did this guy come from? Why did he appear? How did he disappear? He was as solid as you or I. Mm-hmm. Is he going to come back? Why did he come in the first place? Is he going to ask me to do something that I'm going to consider scary or frightening or whatever? And so all these thoughts are running through my mind as I'm trying to get back to sleep, which I finally did. And then I spent the next several days of my life looking over my shoulder all the time and dreading going to sleep because I'm sure this guy is going to come back, which, by the way, he never did. And after that happened, these physical paranormal experiences begin to occur in my life. And I don't mean these were things that I saw in a daydream or a meditation or hallucinated or dreamed or had a vision or anything like that. These were literal physical occurrences on the physical realm, supernaturally caused, and a lot of times were witnessed by other people, including my parents. And it began to dawn on me, even at that young age, I got the revelation that, this guy came to open up that portal so that I would have these experiences. Now, I didn't know why at the time, and of course, I've been a professional psychic for 50 years. I've read for clients in over 40 countries, and I've got a couple of books out. All these wonderful things have happened as a result of that, and part of that's that interaction with the paranormal realm, what it's taught me, what I've learned over the years. And then as I've continued on with that, a few weeks later, I became aware that he had also activated my psychic gift. And the very first way that I found that out was a car pulled into the driveway when I was in the backyard playing one day. Mm-hmm. And I didn't recognize the car or the people. So I ran the house to get my mom and dad. And I said, hey, there's somebody here. I don't know who they are. Says, okay, we'll come look. So they go outside and I said, oh, those are friends of ours. And they were friends I had never met. So they're standing out there on the sidewalk and they're talking and I'm goofing around with my toy and kind of semi eavesdropping. And all of a sudden, I got this vision, and I just walked up and interrupted him, and I looked at the man and his wife, and I said, you guys have just been on vacation, and you drove that car that's in the driveway, and you don't have kids with you today, but you've got two kids, and you took them with you on the vacation, and you stayed in this hotel that was a couple of stories, and it was painted white, and it looked like this in the front. There were these trees spaced like this, and in the back, and the pool area looked like this. And the husband's kind of looking from his wife to my parents and to me and back again, all kind of bemused, like, what's going on here? Mm-hmm. And his wife was looking at me like I had cobras growing out of my ears. She was bug-eyed and slack-jawed. And when I finished my spiel, she looked at my mother for a brief second, looked back at me, still bug-eyed, and said, how the hell could he possibly know that? And my mom said something like, oh, well, you know, kids and their imaginations. And she goes, imaginations? She goes, how the hell could he possibly know that? That's what we came to tell you today was about the vacation that we just returned from, the vacation we just took. We drove that car. We had our two kids with us in the car. The motel that we stayed at was exactly the description that John gave. How the hell could he possibly have known these things? And my mother just kind of shrugged uncomfortably, as did my dad. And they were like, John, go play. And I said, yes, ma'am. Nice to meet you folks. And I ran off. And I guess I scared the hell out of them because I never came back to visit my parents again. And that was my awakening, my psychic awakening, when I learned that I could see into people's lives, went on from there to be able to predict their futures, to read their thoughts, to see where they had been in the past and what had happened there, what was going on in the present, and so on and so forth. So that's when that came about. Like I say, between 5 and 6 years old. And then I started doing everything possible to find out what was real and what wasn't in the psychic realm. Because even at that young age, I said, you know, there's a lot of bullshit going on out here. There's a lot of hooey here in the religious world, in the paranormal world, the spiritual realm. So I began to study everything I could, and I began to get as close to the other side as I could and ask them to reveal to me, hey, what's true and what isn't, what works, what doesn't, how do I make this gift better? How do I get more accurate? So I studied everything on the planet, religion, psychology, parapsychology. I read everything I could get my hands on. Between the ages of about 12 and 15, I started providing readings for friends and family. And then at the age of 18, I started reading professionally and been going ever since.
You say something interesting there. I'm going to rewind on you a little bit first. And sure. you mentioned that the man who came forward and unlocked your gift never appeared before you again. But do you psychically know who that man is?
I have no clue. I don't know if he was someone that used to live there or in the area in the neighborhood. I don't know if he was one of my guardian angels, just some random entity from the other side given a task. I have no idea. I've never seen him again. Mm-hmm. I've never felt him again. I feel like he may be out there on the periphery somewhere, kind of keeping tabs, but that's about the extent of it. And I've often wondered who he was, and my best guess is he was just a guardian angel or a spirit guide come through to activate my gift, open up that doorway, and to get me going, to set me on this pathway. And I'm so thankful he did, so grateful that he did, because it's been a marvelous, wonderful life of great experiences and helping other people. And another benefit was, after initially being scared to death by him, I've never been scared again of any paranormal experience I've encountered, ever.
Really?
And I've had well over 1,000 now in the physical realm, and I've never been scared again. I've been startled. I mean, if I'm sitting here and I'm talking to you and the camera's on, I see somebody appear over my shoulder and I know the house is locked up and I'm alone in it, yeah, I'm going to be startled, turn around and look and see who it is. And then they're going to disappear. And I go, oh, okay. So right. I can be startled. Yes. But I've never been afraid again.
Well, let's go down that rabbit hole then here, John. Why the lack of fear?
I became very comfortable with the experiences at an early age. To me, after that initial experience, they weren't frightening. They were amazing. They were exciting. They were they taught me things, and it was a fascinating realm. And so when these things would occur, it was just like, oh, okay, so there is this other side, this invisible realm, and the beings and the forces and the energies that are there can physically interact upon our visible realm. And that's pretty cool. And that was just the feeling I had about it. I was never scared again. And I experienced a lot as a kid. Mm-hmm. Like I said, you know, I've had well over 1,000 paranormal manifestations in my life, physical manifestations. And they all started and continued when I was, you know, between 5 and 6 years old. And to me, it never frightened me again. It was just something that it introduced a sense of awe in me and a sense of amazement, like, wow, look at this. This is incredible. Who is that that's doing that? Let me see if I can find out. And what else can they do? And what else can I do? How else can we interact? So rather than being anything scary, it was intriguing to me.
Interesting. And we'll get to some of these stories here as we go into the program, and I'll bring up fear throughout the program and why most people would feel fear in that situation and why they would continue to feel fear and why I find it fascinating that you don't. And I'll tie it into, I guess, to your love of motorcycles too, because I find that guys who ride bikes tend to kind of shove fear to the side. There really is a...
Yeah, you have to. When you ride a motorcycle, it's one of those things that if you're fearful of the machine itself, because, you know, it's a heavy, powerful machine, it can fall over on you, you can lose control of it, animals can run out and hit you, cars can hit you, other motorcyclists can hit you. So if these things influence your mind enough that you're fearful on the bike, get rid of it, sell it, and find another sport, another hobby. To ride successfully, you have to be free from fear. You have to be cautious, but you can't be fearful.
Correct.
And I remember the first ride on a motorcycle. I was, I guess, around 15. And I had been over visiting friends of my family's. And I had become friends with them, and I'd go over and visit with them. And His wife answered the door and said, "He's not home, but he'll be here shortly. Come on in." About that time, I heard a motorcycle coming and a horn beeping, and I turned around. Here he was on this bike coming home from work, and I didn't even know he had it. We'd been friends for a long time, and I never knew he rode. He never showed me the motorcycle. Here he come on this motorcycle, pulled up in the driveway, and I was like, "Oh my God, I'm in love. This is the greatest thing I've ever seen in my life."
Yeah.
And he wound up selling me that motorcycle. And that was my first motorcycle and my introduction to two wheels. And it was immediately the most pleasurable thing I'd ever done. It was absolutely fantastic. And I've been in love with two wheels ever since. And it's one of those things that you're respectful of the danger of it, because it is a dangerous sport, but you're respectful of that. You're cautious as you can be when you ride. You teach yourself and you learn all that you can. You learn from others and get as good and as skillful as you can at it, to the point that you relax on it, you enjoy it. And while you're still mindful of everything that's going on, you can, it's pleasurable being on it. You're not tensed up. You're not afraid. You're not scared. And interestingly enough, on my motorcycle, I have had a plethora of mind-blowing paranormal experiences while riding or while going to destinations that I was visiting on the bike.
And I wonder, answer me this, John. I know when you're on that bike, it seems like, and I think I know the answer to this, but clarify it for me if you will. When you're on that bike, it's almost like the mind clears itself. And
absolutely.
You get
it's
to
a
that
very Zen thing.
Yeah.
And you'll hear bikers, myself included, talk about taking a ride to blow the cobwebs out of your head.
Yeah.
And it feels like that. There comes a moment shortly into the ride where you're just one with the machine. You're one with the ride. All your thoughts and cares and worries go away. And you just enjoy the pure sensation of being on the motorcycle. And it's one of the most glorious things there is to me. It's just absolutely fantastic. It's so pleasurable that I tell people, if you do it right, it's almost as good as sex. Not as good, but almost as good as sex if you do it right. And I know a lot of bikers that feel the same way. It sounds strange, but the pleasure of riding is just so intense and so amazing and such an experience. And I don't know of anything else that brings forth that same emotion and sensation and feeling. And I've heard pilots talk about they couldn't wait to get back on the ground so they could get on their motorcycle.
You know, yeah.
These are people that are flying jets and things. They're like, "Man, I can't wait to land so I can get back on the bike." So it's a really fascinating experience, really fascinating feeling. And it does have its zen moments, absolutely.
Well, and you do have a hell of a humming engine between your legs, just to add to that point.
Yep.
But there's something to it too, and correct me if you will, but as you hit that kind of blank slate, that tabula rasa, if you will, is it at that point that it allows spirits to kind of come to you, that it allows you to channel or bring in something to bring you a message?
I imagine for most people it does, but for me, I never have to be in a certain frame of mind or a certain state to get a message from the spirit realm. I've always told people, I said, I can get messages and I can do readings on the Brooklyn Bridge during rush hour. And it's true. I have that ability of concentration, and I've developed and honed that over the years. So I can be in a noisy, crowded restaurant and the guys can give me a message for somebody or whatever. It's just getting that on the bike is kind of doubly pleasurable because I'm in that zone to begin with. And I think it makes it that much more sweet. But it doesn't. I do get into that zone, but I don't have to be there to get messages or experiences from the other side.
Excellent. Excellent. What do you have now for a bike? What are you riding?
I've got a Honda VTX 1300C, big V-twin.
Okay.
And I've got almost 114,000 miles on that bike now. So a lot of serious riding.
Excellent. That's really cool. Let me ask you this. Now, you said you've had experiences while on the bike. Give me an example of something. And I got to think that, first of all, it's weird to have an experience while you're on the bike, but doesn't that throw off your concentration a little bit? I know you're an experienced rider, but wouldn't that throw you off a little bit while you're on the bike?
No, because over the years I've learned to split my focus so that I can receive messages from the other side.
Okay.
And yet stay in focus with the task at hand. So for me, it's easy to receive a message from the other side while on the bike, or have a physical paranormal experience while on the bike and still focus on the act of biking itself. So that's something that I've learned to do over the years so that it doesn't present a danger to me or others when I have these experiences. And the other side knows that, or they wouldn't give them to me. And I'll give you one example where the other side literally saved my life.
Okay,
while I was,
sure.
While I was motorcycling.
Yeah.
And I had taken a day off and going down one of the interstates here. And I tell people in Florida, the right lane on the interstate is 70 miles per hour, which everybody ignores, you know, and they go 80 plus in the right lane, the slow lane, so-called. And then in the middle lane, it's 90 plus. The left lane, all bets are off. Everybody over there imagines they're training for the Daytona 500 or something. It's really crazy. So I've scheduled myself a day off, and I have this long, pleasurable ride ahead of me. And it's a beautiful day, blue skies and sunshine. And so I'm tooling along in the right lane, and I'm going like 65, 70. Mm-hmm. I'm just geezering it that day because I just want to enjoy the ride, be out in the countryside, enjoy the feeling of the fresh air blowing on me and the hum of the machine and everything else. And, of course, people are passing me left and right and pulling out around me because I'm only going 70, and they're, you know, they're disgusted with going that slow behind me. I'm like, good grief. So, like I say, I'm just going real slow because I'm enjoying it. Mm-hmm. And this audible voice in my head says, move into the far left lane. And I'm like, and it's going to take a lot longer to tell you this about this than for the actual occurrence, okay, because it was only split seconds. But it takes a lot longer to tell it. And so for all of these years of experience with the other side, I start arguing with them. I'm like, guys, I don't want to move in the far left lane. I'm going to have to bob and weave and do some real serious riding here. And it's going to be brakes on, brakes off, upshift, downshift, throttle on, throttle off. And it's bob and weave and lean through traffic and everything. And I can do that. And I have very, very good high speed riding capabilities. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to be going fast that day. I want to be goofing around, just enjoying the ride.
Right.
And a split second later, they say, John, move into the far left lane now. So, okay, whatever. So I start jockeying over there and getting to the far left lane. And I'm like, okay, what in the world was all that about, guys? And a split second later, this crash occurs in the right lane where I was at. And then somebody hit this guy or he hit somebody, but his car is spinning around in that lane. We actually make eye contact. I look over and look at him, and we lock eyes as he's spinning around in the car.
Whoa.
And he winds up facing the wrong way in the right lane on the interstate. And there's detritus blowing like shrapnel across all three lanes, hubcaps and pieces of bumper and this and the other, all kinds of debris that I'm now having to dodge. And so I looked to see if I need to slow down, but there's already people stopping and people avoiding the wreck. And there's going to be people that are going to call the highway patrol and whatever is necessary. So I keep on going, mm-hmm, thankfully unscathed. And so the point of that is that if I hadn't listened and moved over, then I would have been the first one to hit this guy. And how many people would have hit me? And I wouldn't be here to tell you this story. I'd be on the other side now figuring out what to do over there.
Yeah, you would.
And, you know, people say, well, look, that was a, you know, that's a hair's breadth away from death. That's got to be a, you know, wow. Why didn't your guardian angels tell you not to take that road that day to go some other way? They could have.
Right.
But then by having that experience, then I've got a way for you to have a graphic example of how guardian angels will communicate with us and save us if we'll listen and we'll pay attention. And it's a very, very dramatic tale to tell. But that was what they gave me to give to you. And they gave that to me as a gift for everybody, to tell everybody that story as an encouragement to people to listen to your guardian angels. And when you hear from them, react appropriately, do what they tell you, and they will watch over you and take care of you. So, well, you know, people die all the time. Yes, they do. Maybe we have an appointed time. Maybe those people weren't listening to their guardian angels, went against what they were told to do. You said, well, why would people do that? Well, when 9/11 happened, the managers came in and told everybody, go back to your desk, sit down, everything's okay, everything's under control. If those people had listened to their intuition and their fear and got the heck out of there, they'd still be alive, a lot of them.
Right.
So, you know, people don't listen, and we have to learn to listen, number one, and then we have to act on what we're told, number two.
You know, you said something earlier that that really set off those bells like you're talking about. And that was when you were younger, you had asked for discernment from your guides. You had asked for discernment from some of the flim-flam artists, for lack of a better term, some of the ones that were practicing shenanigans, some of the ones that were less than truthful that were out there, which I find fascinating for someone who's younger and starting out in this field. There are a lot of people out there that get into the field because they realize that there is quick money to be made in it.
Con artist, scam artist,
Walk me through it for a second. Why, at such a young age, when you realize that you have this gift, that automatically the first thing you ask for is for the gift of discernment to be able to call out such scam artists?
Right. The thing that happened to me, Tim, it was really interesting. Even at a very young age, I had a very prickly conscience. I wasn't a good liar and all that type of thing. And so I had a strong moral sense, even at a young age. Mm-hmm. And I would see people, the adults around me and the kids around me, but also the adults, I would see them lie and I would see them cheat and I would see them steal. I would see them flim-flam people. And even in the church and even in the spiritual community, I became aware that this went on. And it upset me to a horrible degree because I thought, you know, if these things are true that we're experiencing and you claim to believe in that, then how could you go out and take advantage of your fellow man? Mm-hmm. How could you con them out of money? You know, how could you con them into sex or other favors or whatever in the name of God or in the name of the spiritual realm or in the name of some psychic or paranormal power? How could you do that if you really believe this? Because I knew it was real. I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt it was real. And I discovered that there were some people then that, like you said, they said, oh, there's money to be made off these suckers. And they had probably never had a genuine spiritual experience in their life, probably never believed in any of it, but said, okay, I can walk the walk, I can talk the talk, and I can get money off of these suckers. And that's the ones that I especially hate. And then I think there were others that people think they have a gift, or they may have a little bit of a gift, and they want that. They want that recognition. They want that fame or whatever. And they interject themselves into the spiritual realm where they shouldn't. They're in a place where they shouldn't be, trying to do things that they're not capable of and that they shouldn't. And then I think that there are some people that may have started out on the right foot, and then as time goes by, maybe the effort's too much, maybe the temptation or the lure of money or whatever is too much, and they kind of begin to fudge things a little bit or you know, kind of skate a little bit, so to speak. And that disturbed me, and it's one thing I can say with pride. As a human being, I've been an asshole sometimes in my life, you know, like all of us are. I've been very, very imperfect as a person. I've had my ups and downs and my failures and my goof-ups and everything else. But one thing I can say with pride, I have never, ever, ever one time conned anyone, fudged anything, pretended something happened that it didn't or anything like that with my psychic gift and in the paranormal realm. That's been something that has been 100% legit all the way through, and it's cost me. There are people that don't like to hear the truth, and there are people that if they know you're coming after them, even if you're a big name, and if they know somebody that's got the goods or can expose some of that is coming after you, they don't like that. You know, they're going to be afraid of you or try and somehow stop you or whatever. And then, of course, it's just, you know, the monetary factor. I don't make a lot of money doing this. You know, it's, well, my God, if you're as good a psychic as you say and as your clients say, why aren't you rich? Because I don't charge people an arm and a leg for what I do. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't charge them for my gift. I charge them for my time. And I try to keep that at a reasonable enough dollar amount that it's affordable. And that after I pay all of my fees and my taxes, and my income taxes and everything else, material expenses, that I can make a little bit, you know, and kind of keep going a little bit. And so that's what I try and do. And, it's, you know, I've certainly never made a lot of money at it. I'm certainly not rich, but I lay my head down at night on the pillow and I can sleep with a clear conscience knowing that I have never conned anybody. I've never taken advantage of anybody. I've refused to read for people. I've said, no, you don't need a reading. You need this bit of advice. Take this and go. And then down the road in 6 months, if you need one, holler. But right now you don't need a reading. I've refunded people's money that have paid me. I've refunded their money, called them up and said, I just refunded your money. You don't need a reading right now. You need this little small piece of advice. Take that and go. Then come back to me if you need to. And the old lady's always like, you're the worst businessman I've ever seen. I said, well, probably right, but I'm the best psychic you'll ever see. I'm the most honest person in that profession that you'll ever see with what I've done. So that's always been an important thing to me. And people may not realize, Tim, how much deceit and fraud there is out there. There is a tremendous amount. I've had clients I've had to rescue ever since I've been doing this, from the phonies and the fakes and the frauds. Some people are into these people for $50,000, $75,000, $100,000 before they wise up and bail out. And you say, well, if you're that damn ignorant, you deserve what you get. I've had people that own businesses, had three college degrees and a genius IQ, a tested genius IQ, fall prey to these people. They're con artists, confidence artists. They know how to gain your confidence. They're good at what they do. They're skilled at what they do. And they know what makes John Russell tick. And they know what makes Tim Dennis tick. And they know what makes the next person down the road tick. And they know what makes the bank president tick. And they know how to push those buttons convincingly. And after a while, most people wise up, but unfortunately, to the tune of thousands or tens of thousands of dollars lost before they do. And then you say, well, you know, isn't there laws to prosecute these people? Well, while my wife and I were living in New York, we were watching a documentary show, a news show on TV, and they had the New York State Attorney General on there. And they were talking about these phony psychics. And he said, well, they're so hard to prosecute because most of them have never been used their real name, their birth name, in their entire life. Right. So we don't know who we're looking for. Yep. They move a lot. They move around a lot. So it's difficult to get, you know, pin tabs on them and everything. And he said, most of these phony psychics in New York, you know, here's your $5 special reading, $10 special reading. Well, that hooks you to come in. Then they get their hooks in you and start bleeding you for money. Mm-hmm. And he said, these people aren't anywhere from, or scam, anywhere from $100,000 to $250,000 a year, just per person. And he said, and here's the problem. He said, if we do manage to find out who the person actually is, and we manage to track them down, find out where they're currently at, and we decide to do something about it, about this time across my desk comes a serial killer case, your phony psychic goes on the back burner.
Right.
You know,
right.
So that's one of the problems out there. And unfortunately, the industry is not very self-policing. We tend to overlook a lot. And that's one of the things that I'm grousing about constantly about the psychic, the paranormal field, the field of ufology and everything else, is we gloss over and excuse and allow way too much nonsense. And that's what scares off the serious researchers. And that's what scares off people that might actually be saying, well, hey, you know, I just saw in the government UFO report, the government acknowledges these are real physical craft and they're not ours. Wow, I need to get into that. And then you get into that and you get some goofball that, well, I've met the aliens and they're going to reveal themselves in 2 months. I don't know why it's always 2 months. Everything's always 2 months.
Yeah.
And then when you get involved with goofballs like that, somebody that might be on the fence and might be kind of interested, oh, man, I'm not getting involved with these loonies. That's a bunch of nonsense. So and then I think the government has disinformation agents out there and so on and so forth. So it's a big mess that we need to clean up.
Let me ask you a question as far as this goes, John. You talk about self-policing, but is there policing on the other side? And what I mean by that is, there's a fine line when it comes to getting the message out and advancing a cause. So and let me clarify this. Obviously, spirit has a message, and spirit has a message of you know, this thing is real. Right. And you can communicate with loved ones, and you need to have peace of mind that you can go about your life and know that there is something on the other side when we pass.
Right.
And that you need to whatever that message is that you need to get, you can get it and then move on and live your life. And that at some point, you know, you can, you know, I guess for lack of a better term, you can go to this spiritualist or this medium, get your advice and then move on. And then if you need to come back to them, you can come back to them. Right. So where does spirit come in and police the spiritual medium?
That's a good question. We see what our eyes seem to perceive and see a lot of latitude from the spiritual realm. I'll give you examples, and it kind of mystifies me why this is. You know, people are always fond of saying that there's karma and it's going to get you in the end, and what goes around comes around, and, you know, God's judgment is coming, and we can rest assured on that and all this. And I think all that's BS. If you think that what goes around comes around, or karma's going to get you, or God's going to punish you, or the spiritual realm's going to punish you, all you have to do is look at the life of the notorious gangsters that have lived in the past.
Right.
And they hacked up people and buried them in garbage bags and did all kinds of hideous things. And they had immense, enormous wealth. Mm-hmm. They enjoyed great lives with beautiful women. All the homes and cars and luxury they wanted. They ate the finest foods up till the end of days. And it's like, okay, there's no karma evident there. You know, you say, well, maybe the afterlife. Well, maybe, maybe not. Why didn't they punish them here? Why didn't they stop them here? How many victims of serial killers or mobsters or gangsters or whatever have been praying till their blood squeezed out of them nearly, done something to save their lives, and it didn't happen? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm not real convinced, real keen on this idea of karma or this instant judgment or what goes around comes around, because there's too many people that are evil that live good lives and prosperous lives. And so that's something that's always befuddled me and befuddled all serious thinkers that inquire into this realm, is how come? And we don't really know. And we do see some instances where it appears that some people do get some type of reprisal or some type of punishment for something they've done, but it doesn't seem to be wholesale. It's like with the phony psychics and the phony people in religion, the phony televangelists that rake in millions of dollars and live these lavish lifestyles, and you don't see them get cancer or die or somebody beat them up or lose their fortune or anything else. And it's like, how come? Why? And then you see people that are down in the trenches trying to do serious spiritual work and do real spiritual work. And most likely they're down and out or just eking by, just getting by. And a lot of times beset with a lot of health issues, a lot of problems and everything. And it's like, this is kind of topsy-turvy, isn't it? Shouldn't it be the other way around? But it isn't, you know, I mean, that's the reality of it. And why that is, I don't know. I'm not a big believer in the pie in the sky by and by. Well, we'll be rewarded for this in the afterlife. I'm not a big believer in that. From what I've been able to glimpse, from what my friends and loved ones on the other side have told me about the afterlife and what spirits on the other side have told me about that, that doesn't necessarily seem to be the case. So why is it that way? I don't know. And I'm not sure that anybody else does. But it does seem like there is a lack of immediate or even in the long run punishment or anything meted out to all these phonies and fakes. And why that is, I don't know.
Well, you might have just answered the next question that I want to throw at you, John. And this would be a good place after you answer this for us to break and then come back. And that is there such thing as eternal punishment for the big baddies, like you had mentioned, for gangsters, for dictators, for those that really do trespass against
like that,
trespass against humanity?
Right. You know, we don't know. We hope there is, but we don't know for a certainty exactly what the other side is like. We get bits and pieces of it. We get hints. We get little small glimpses of it, but we don't absolutely know for 100% certainty. And if there is any goodness in this world, if there is any justice in this world, and when I say this world, I mean all of it, all combined, the universe, the invisible and visible realms. If there's any justice at all, you would think that, well, the souls of these people, after they're dead, can't just go to the other side and continue to prosper and continue to wreak havoc and mayhem. There has to be some type of containment or punishment or something there, surely. Mm-hmm. Whether it's everlasting or not, you know, who knows? I mean, you know, we've got various holy books, including our own Bible, that speak of eternal torment or everlasting punishment or whatever. But, and I can say this as an ordained minister who was at one time an associate pastor of a small church for a brief amount of time and who studied the Bible inside and out and tried to apply it. The Bible got a lot of problems. So, you know, we have to take things that we get from, especially from holy books, so-called, with a large grain of salt, because we go and try and put those things into practice, mm-hmm. and they don't work. And you can demonstrate that they don't work. So for something to make an authoritative statement and us to take that at face value and run with it, I don't think we can do that. There's just too much that we still don't know.
All right. That's going to lead to an interesting transition into our next segment here, in that you filmed a show for History Channel having to do with the assassination of President Lincoln. And in our next segment, we'll talk a little bit about that show that you filmed and actually channeling that fateful day. And and so we'll talk a bit about that and a bit about the souls that have passed on since then. Our guest is psychic John Russell. And we have a link to his, actually, he's got a couple of websites here, but johnrussell.net is the main one. But we've got links to all his websites on the description of this show. He's got a couple of books out there. Riding with Ghosts, I believe, is the first one, right, John?
Yeah, Riding with Ghosts, Angels and the Spirits of the Dead. That's my first book. The second book is A Knock in the Attic.
And you're also working on a third book, correct?
I'm working on a third book right now. It's going to be 20 Ways to Increase Your Psychic Abilities. And it's kind of unique in this literature because I take one technique per chapter. So there'll be 20 techniques in the book. And I start off with example. The first chapter is on psychometry. And so what I do with each psychic, spiritual, paranormal tool or technique is I define it. I tell you what it is. I tell you how to learn it, how to practice it and get good at it, and then the real world application of that. And the book's written so that if nobody thinks I have any psychic ability, nobody's ever studied anything, I'm going to walk you through it step by step, hold your hand, tell you exactly how to do it, how to learn it, then how to apply it in the real world. And I do that for everything in all of the chapters. So it should be an exciting book when I'm done with it.
It sounds exciting. So during the break, check out the link in the description of this show, both for the books Riding with Ghosts, Angels and Spirits of the Dead, and A Knock in the Attic, True Ghost Stories and Other Spine-Chilling Paranormal Adventures. Be sure to pick up both books. They both sound exciting. Again, our guest is psychic and author John Russell. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about the assassination of Abraham Lincoln and that fateful special that John filmed. You're listening to the best in paranormal podcasting. This is Darkness Radio.
Let's check in with golf legend John Daly.
I only spend on Moto, America's social casino. You know, I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. That's Daly. Moto Casino, hands down, has the best VIP experience. Take it from one high roller to another.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces. If you're ready to go for the greens with me, grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto.us.
Visit Modo.us for the best free play social casino experience wherever you are. Moto offers a huge selection of Vegas-style games and now introducing live blackjack, roulette, and casino hold'em. These are so much fun. Moto always has generous jackpots, free spins, and exciting promotions. Register today at Modo.us for your free welcome bonus.
Moto is a social casino. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Conditions apply. See website for details.
Modo.us.
It's time to play big on Moto Social Casino. America's hottest free-to-play social casino experience. Moto.us has live casino games. It's time! Play big, win bigger on Moto.us today.
Moto is a social casino, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Visit Moto.us for more details.
It's time!
Moto.us.
Welcome back to the Best in Paranormal Podcasting. This is Darkness Radio on a Thursday. I'm Tim Dennis. Our guest is psychic and author John Russell. And the books that you want to keep in mind and go out and get right now, the link, by the way, in the description of the show, are Riding with Ghosts, Angels, and the Spirits of the Dead, and A Knock in the Attic, True Ghost Stories and Other Spine-Chilling Paranormal Adventures. Again, the link for both books in the description of this show. John, before we left everybody in the break, we were talking about a special that you filmed for the History Channel. And what impressed me the most was the fact that it was either the producer or the director for the show on History Channel didn't say he was a skeptic. He said he was a cynic.
Yeah, that's my friend Jim Mullen. We became friends after we shot the pilot. Mm-hmm. It was real interesting the way that came about. At the time, getting a psychic to investigate things or having a psychic as part of your investigative team was really popular, and so the History Channel just wanted to get in on that. Mm-hmm. And they came up with this concept. The series was going to be called Psychic History. And my job was going to be to go to various historical locations and give them my input of what occurred there.
Okay.
So a great concept. And the producer, my producer, Jim Mullen, like I said, we later became fast friends and still are to this day. He initially was like, yeah, okay, well, whatever, psychic, you know, I've got a job to do. We'll go and see what we can do with this guy on camera. And, I could tell that he was very skeptical or very cynical from the get-go. And so my mission in life was to make everybody on the crew, all the camera people and everybody else, believers. And I successfully did that, I think, for everybody on the crew by the time we had wrapped up filming. And so the concept of the show, and it unfortunately never aired. And I find out that this is pretty common that they'll spend money to do something and then never air it. And it broke my heart because I think, in all honesty, I think we would have set the bar for every paranormal show to come for a long time. It was that good because I got to solve the fine cut of it that was going to go to air. And it was just really, really a good job. Very respectful, mm-hmm. No yelling and challenging at the ghosts or any of that nonsense.
Yeah.
And, no, I demand you show yourself. We didn't do any of that kind of nonsense. When we began filming, the really neat thing about getting to interact with the crew members, I'll give you one example, like where I was determined to make everybody a believer. And, we had, people think that doing TV is glamorous. It's not.
No.
You get up at 4 or 5 in the morning to be ready for casting call at 6, and you film until 6 that evening, maybe 9 that evening, maybe 10 or 11 that evening, mm-hmm. try and get some sleep, get up and do it all over again. And so it really is grueling, and there's not much, not much glamorous about it at all. It's work. It's really hard work. Mm-hmm. And so we were up one morning and or maybe it was mid-morning, maybe it was afternoon, I don't even remember, but we had shot like for a week. And one of those days we were in the van and we filmed even in the van, and we were going, and my producer got a call on his phone, and my psychic gift kicked in, and I said, and I tapped him on the leg, and I said, you know, he knew I wouldn't interrupt him unless it was something important. And I said, listen, I said, it's the guy you're talking to, right? He goes, somebody tells the guy, he says, hang on just a second. And he goes, yeah, he says, a friend of mine. And I said, somebody has just died and named him the executor of the estate, and he's got the will there. He's looking over the will. He has it with him. And I said, tell him that he needs to make sure in this will all the T's are crossed and the proverbial I's are dotted. And so my producer's looking at me like I'm something out of left field. And he says, okay. So he gets back on the phone with this guy and he says, hey, he said, has someone just, some friend or family member of yours just died and left you as the executor of the estate and you've got the will and everything? And there was this little pause and he goes, uh-huh, okay. And he said, well, and the guy's like, how did you know that? So he said, well, we're filming with a psychic. And he said, the psychic just interrupted me and told me to tell you this. And he said, he told me to tell you to really go over the will with a fine tooth comb, make sure everything's in order. All the T's are crossed, all the I's are dotted. And so the guy was like, wow, this should be a really interesting show. And so those were the types of things that came to me that the other side gave me to make believers out of everybody in the cast and crew. And so that was really exciting to be able to do those types of things. And then because it was the History Channel and Atlas Media and the History Channel still have, I believe, a co-copyright of the pilot episode, which is really kind of strange for it to be under copyright by two people. But Atlas Media was one of the biggest media corporations in New York, and that was we were shooting under the auspices of the History Channel. So with the cachet of both of those combined, we had doors thrown open to us that nobody else could gain access to, or that there had been some of these goofball psychics in the past there and had left such bad taste in the people's mouths that they said, we're never going to open up our doors to anything like this again. Mm-hmm. Mm. So one example of that was one place, psychic, this lady and her husband or boyfriend came in or whatever, and she got in there and said, oh, this ghost touched me. And then she fainted and the boyfriend had to grab her. And they were like, get out of here. Don't ever come back. Don't ever open the doors to anybody like this again. So the fact that these places would allow us in after these experiences, we had that credibility, that cachet from the History Channel, from Atlas Media. So we were granted carte blanche to Ford's Theater and to all of these other great places, to the Samuel Mudd House, with no tourists there. The only people there were the docents. We had the run of the place, just me and the film crew. And it was just absolutely marvelous to be able to go in all of these places where these historic events occurred and to film there. So it was really great, really fantastic. And I'm so sorry that it never aired. And I was under a 5-year contract. And it would have been like, wow, this would have been really great. And, you know, we'd have really gotten across some good truth and some good examples of what it really is like to interact with the paranormal in a real way. And then to get what stories you could from those experiences to share with people, to learn what you could, not just to have the experience, but why is that ghost interacting this way? Why is this entity doing that? What actually happened there? And, one of the things, I'll give you an example of getting to the real meat of it.
Sure.
Under the theater, there's a little museum down there with some items that were Lincoln's or replicas of items that were his. And one of them was the door to the presidential box. And it had the hole in it. And it says this hole was drilled by John Wilkes Booth so he could look in and see where the president was, so he went to burst in on him and shoot him. Mm-hmm. And I looked at that and I said, no, that's not right. I said, Booth didn't drill that hole. I said, Booth had that hole drilled by someone that was probably a workman in the theater that by being there wouldn't arouse suspicion. And Booth didn't drill that hole. So sure enough, after we wrapped the shoot, we went and did, or they did, all of this extensive research on the things that I had said to see if they could indeed verify them. A lot were real easy to verify. But this one thing about the hole, they poured through every Lincoln book and every Lincoln thing they could find. And sure enough, they found out that the theater owner said that a workman had drilled the hole in the door and not Booth.
Wow.
So that was my aim in going into this and doing this, was not just to get the edge of your seat moments, and not just to raise the viewer's hair on their arms. Oh boy, I can't wait. The commercial's over and what happens next? It wasn't that. I mean, although it had to be entertaining, obviously, but it was, okay, let's sort out all the truth that we can here, and let's find out why a lot of these things occurred and so on and so forth. So that was part of the fun of doing that for me.
That is exciting. I mean, you know, just that little revelation there is enough to, I would think, to make them want to get that out and release to the public.
Yeah. I wish that they would have. And I have my theories as to why it didn't go out, but I may be wrong on that. My producer and I have discussed it, and he says, you know, he's an award-winning producer and had done TV for a long time. And he said, sometimes that's just the way. You can have two or three, four or five episodes in a can, and they decide, nope, we're not going with it. So
yeah,
that might be a possibility. But one of the things that I encountered at one place, I was, one of the docents was there, and I was giving her my psychic impressions about the history of the place, the people that were there, and the things that were done there, and the things they did, and some of the activities that occurred there. And she had this real weird look on her face. And so we got to a break in the filming. We're setting up in another room. And so there was an empty room there in the house. And I grabbed her and I said, hey, come here a minute, would you please? So we went in there off in this other room by ourselves. And I said, do me a favor. I said, you seem to be looking at me kind of weird. And I said, I want to find out why. I said, of all the things that I'm telling you psychically, you're saying, yeah, okay, whatever this and the other. But I said, a lot you're not commenting on, or you're looking at me kind of weird. I said, what's your hit-miss ratio here with me? And she goes, oh, my God. She said, it's absolutely freaky. She said, just about everything you're saying, I can agree with or verify or whatever. Or, you know, it's been inferred that has happened here, occurred here, or whatever. I said, so why the weird look on your face? And she goes, well, there are still descendants of those people in this area. And if I get on camera and say, yeah, to all of this stuff that you're saying, I'm probably going to lose my job.
Wow.
Yeah. So my theory, and it's only a theory, may not amount to a hill of beans, but my theory is we may have rankled some nerves along the way, and somebody with some power, authority, money, whatever, may have called up History Channel and said, hey, nix this, you know. Or not, you know, but just based upon some things that happened, I have to throw that at least into the realm of possibility.
So are you saying you found a controversial angle to why President Lincoln was killed?
Not that, but Samuel Mudhouse. My theory was that Mudd knew Booth when he came to his house to be treated for his broken leg. Mudd had met, and this is common knowledge in history, this is acknowledged that Mudd had met with Booth at least a couple of times previously. He had gone up to Booth's hotel room, and they had had drinks together and talked about land and horses and this that, and the other. So he knew Booth. And what I learned after all of this, and it was so neat going in to be the one chosen to do this, because I'm the worst student of history on the entire planet. I know nothing about it. Okay. I hate it. I don't like it. I was the guy in history class, wrote the dates on his palm to cheat on the test because I couldn't remember them. Mm-hmm. I just hated it.
Yeah.
So what I got that they verified had to be coming from my psychic gift. Mm-hmm. And one of the things, so I'm finding out all these things about history that a lot of people know that was just news to me. For example, Booth was the Tom Cruise of his day. He was that well known and that popular. And as being that well known, anybody would recognize him from anywhere, even the most casual person that didn't know him. Oh, look, there goes Booth. So for Mudd to have drank with the guy, sat in his room with him, met him on two different occasions at least, and then to come by, and Booth being the most famous person on the planet practically at the time, for Mudd to say, well, I didn't recognize him, that didn't sit well with me. I said, no. I said, he knew who it was. He had to have known who it was.
Yeah.
And he said, well, Booth was in disguise, but yet later the authorities that came by, the law enforcement authorities and everything that came by to question Mudd, said that Mudd gave him an exact description of Booth. And he knew Booth. So to give him that exact description, so on and so forth. But that's a real, real touchy thing with the Mudd estate, the Mudd family to this day, is that they will deny any complicity or knowledge or anything on Dr. Mudd's behalf, as far as having had anything to do with Booth or knowing who he was or anything like that. So by me saying, yeah, he knew who he was, and there may have even been some type of thing where, well, if you get into trouble, you know where to come if you need some, you know, some medical help or whatever, because he went straight to Booth. I mean, straight to Mudd. He went straight to his house. He knew where he was at. Hmm. And so that was one thing that I think rankled a few people, and it didn't sit well. It didn't sit well while we were there, because I disagreed with the people to their face while we were filming, and said, well, I don't buy that. So interesting things like that. And maybe that had something to do with it. Maybe not. I don't know.
That's very interesting indeed.
Yeah.
Switching gears here, John, you had a UFO experience in Roswell.
Well, I call it my Roswell UFO experience.
Okay. Yeah.
I kind of do that as a teaser, okay. But it was absolutely mind blowing.
Okay.
I had gone to, there was an event called Alien Encounter 98.
Okay.
And I had a booth there doing readings. And Stanton Friedman was there lecturing, and a lot of other people. So just incredibly amazing. Excuse me. And so I got up one morning. I said, well, here I am in Roswell. I've got to do the tourist thing. I've got to go to the UFO museum before I start my day and begin my readings and everything.
Sure.
So I go down to the UFO museum. I'm standing out on the sidewalk. It's not open yet. I'd gotten there a little early, so I'm peering in the door, trying to peer in the windows, looking at the displays or whatever. And there's not much foot traffic. There's hardly anybody going by. And this lady comes down the sidewalk, and I nod at her and say hi, and she nods at me and say hi, and we exchange pleasantries, and she stops. And she goes, and going into the museum, and I said, yeah, I'm just waiting for it to open. Got here a little early, and she says, is that your first time to the museum? I said, well, not only the first time to the museum, but my first time to Roswell. Actually, my first time here to New Mexico to really do anything. And she goes, oh, well, what do you do? And I said, oh, boy, here it goes. So I said, well, I'm a psychic, and I'm doing readings over at Alien Encounter 98. And she looks at me, and she says, well, you'll believe what I'm going to tell you then. I'm like, oh, okay, this is getting interesting. She said, when I was a child, me and my brother were outside playing, and we saw the UFO fly over and saw it crash off over in the distance. I said, lady, you have got my attention. So she said, we could tell that it was in some type of trouble from the way that it was going through the air. And she said, we saw it fairly close and clearly. We knew it was not a plane, a helicopter, weather balloon, or anything else. It was definitely a UFO. And then we saw it crash off over in the distance. And I was like, my God. I said, this is incredible. I said, let me ask you a question. I said, have you ever, you know, come forth and like been on a TV show or written something, maybe a magazine article, been interviewed for anything like this? She's like, no. And I wouldn't. And never have. And I said, well, why not? I said, my God, imagine if you saw this in person and could come forth and with this information, and how many other people out there maybe also. I said, why not? And she said, well, at the time, there were people from the government, people from the military, people that we didn't know who the heck were, that showed up to various people in town and threatened their families basically with, and this is her words, this is what she told me. She said, basically with, if you talk to anyone about this, your bones are going to be found out in the desert.
Yo.
And she said, you know, there's a lot of brave people that were here at the time, and they may not have been swayed by that threat, but they had families. And so it's like, well, you don't scare me, but you know, if you're also threatening my wife and my young children with death and just threatening wiping out all of us, I care enough about them that, okay, I'll shut up and I'll be quiet and leave things alone.
Yeah.
And I said, well, that makes sense, you know, given the history of what we read about the people that were threatened to keep quiet at Roswell, but to actually meet a person that experienced that. And all of a sudden, she snaps her head left and right a couple of times, looks up and down the street and said, I've said too much already. I'm sorry. I got to go by, and takes off at a brisk clip. And I was like, wow. One of the most mind-blowing experiences I ever had.
Wow. Huh.
Incredible.
Interesting. Very interesting indeed. So have you yourself ever had a UFO experience or contact?
I've seen several. And one of the interesting things, and I write about that in my book, my first book, is that I was around, around 20, somewhere around there. And I was already reading professionally, and I'd already had this plethora of paranormal experiences on the physical realm. And I did not believe in UFOs. I didn't believe they existed. I read the books. I read the magazine articles. I read the interviews. I saw people talk about it on TV. And I said, nope, not having it. And so I was, it's a rather long story, but it kind of leads up to the possible paranormal implications or affiliations with UFOs. So I'll include that as well. Okay. And I had been to this building and was coming out. My car was parked across the street in a parking lot, small parking lot. It was only a 2-lane narrow street, and I could see my car from in the parking lot when I came out the door. Now, this is back in West Texas where I grew up, and we have severe, violent weather there. Mm-hmm. And growing up in that, I knew all the signs of bad storms and everything. When I came out the door, first thing that hits me in the face is this blast of wind. I looked up. The skies are low and dark. And I thought, oh, boy, here we go. So I said, I better get to my car real quick. So I look over, and right by my car, down in the parking lot, connected to the clouds above, but down in the parking lot, is this column of cloud that's about maybe, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 feet in diameter. And it's just kind of whirling and rotating and pulsating. And my first thought is, oh, boy, a tornado or at least a dust devil or whatever. But it's just sitting there. And I notice something super odd. None of the debris in the parking lot by the base of the cloud is blowing or moving around. So nothing is affecting all this loose debris there. And I'm like, well, what in the world? And as I look at this thing, these globules, these glowing globules, maybe about the size of a bowling ball or a basketball, emerge from this cloud, kind of push out from it, and then recede back into it, all up and down the length of the cloud. And they're phosphorescent colors, orange, yellow, green, blues, and reds. And honest to God, Tim, the first thing that comes through my mind, here I am, relatively healthy 20-year-old, I think, and the first thought that comes through my mind was, that's it. I've had a stroke. I've gone nuts. I've lost it. I guess I'll just go get in my car, go to the hospital, say, hey, guys, you know. And then I have this super strange, weird urge. And I have the urge to walk toward the parking lot, toward the cloud. So I take a few steps forward, and the cloud advances in the parking lot toward me. And I stop, and it stops. I back up, and it backs up. I take steps toward it. It advances toward me. I stop. It stops. I back up. It backs up. And I'm back by the building now, by the door. And the door opens, whacks me in the back. And a buddy of mine comes out and goes, oh, man, sorry I hit you. What are you doing so close by the door? And without even waiting for me to answer, he looks up and says, oh, boy, looks like we're in for it. And then he looks down the parking lot and he goes, what in the world is that? And I'm like, oh, hallelujah. I'm not nuts, because he sees it too. I'm not insane. So he stands there and I say, watch this, watch this. And I walk toward the cloud and it advances toward me. And I stop and it stops. I back up and it backs up. And I do that a few times. And I say, isn't that the weirdest thing you ever saw? And he looks at me like I'm the weirdest thing he's ever seen. And he says, bye. And he's out of there. He's gone. His car's in another direction. And he leaves. That's like got him freaked out. So I'm like, oh, great. So now here I am with this thing. What do I do and how do I get to my car? Mm-hmm. And about that time, it sucks back up into the clouds above and all the clouds start to move over very quickly. So I run for my car and I get in and I'm like, what in God's name was that? So I start my car up, start pulling out. Now, this town I grew up in, I know literally like the back of my hand. And to this day, you couldn't get me lost in the town, even with all the new construction, everything else. There's not an area, a section, a neighborhood of the town from north, south, east to west, city limit to city limit that I don't know like the back of my hand.
Okay.
So when I pull out, that serves me real well because I know exactly where I'm at on all the streets. And the reason that's important is because it begins to rain. Now, this is not one of those everything's bigger in Texas stories. I mean, this rain comes down unlike anything I have ever seen in my life, Tim. It starts to rain so hard that with my headlights on, with my wipers going full speed, I cannot see but about a foot past the hood of my car.
Mm.
There are cars angle parked on the side of the street. I can't see them out the side window. That's how hard it's raining. And I'm like, oh my God, I can't, what am I going to do? I'm going to hit somebody. Somebody's going to hit me. I'm going to sideswipe one of these angle park cars. And I see this little tiny glow, and it dawns on me that it's the glow from a stoplight. And I almost rear in this car in front of me. I'm almost on their bumper before my headlights pick them up, and how dark it is. And this car behind me, I see their headlights and them jam on the brakes, and they nearly hit me. I'm like, this is crazy. I can't keep driving like this. I'm going to hit somebody. Somebody's going to hit me. So I know that I'm on Tuig Street, and we had a Sears Roebuck store there that faced Beauregard, and the back of it had this big parking lot that faced Tuig Street, and they had a big auto center out there and all this. So I said, okay, if I can just creep up enough to find the entrance to that parking lot, I'll get in there. Don't care how I park. Don't even care if I'm in a space. I'll get out. I know I'll be soaked to the bone, but I'm going to run in there. Sears had one of the best sporting goods stores on the planet down the basement at that time. Okay. I said, I'll go in and look at the sporting goods till the storm lifts and it's safe to come out and drive, and then I'll drive home. I don't care how wet I get. So I'm creeping along, trying to see this car in front of me and trying to lean over and see if I'm about to sideswipe the angle park cars. And we're all poking along, you know, maybe a mile an hour. I mean, just ridiculously slow because you can't see. And all of a sudden, imagine that description, Tim. And then 1 second later, there's no moisture at all, no rain, nothing. There's not even a mist on the windshield. Right now, I can't see a foot past the hood of my car. 1 second later, there's total visibility. No rain, not a mist, no nothing.
Whoa.
And the clouds are still there. They're still down low, but it's still overcast, but not a drop of rain. I look behind me. I can see all the way behind me. I can see all the way in front of me, all the way around me. Not a drop, not a mist. I reach up, turn my wipers off. There's not even a mist hitting the windshield. It's just totally stopped, just disappeared. The rain has just vanished. And all of a sudden, instead of the traffic moving, the people in the oncoming lane start swerving into our lane and nearly hitting cars in our lane. People are honking and yelling. And I'm like, what in God's name is going on? And people are starting to roll down their windows and point up at the sky. And people are opening their doors and getting out of their cars and pointing up. And I look to where they're pointing. And by then, I'm right at the entrance to the Sears building, to the parking lot. And right over the Sears building, hovering there, about 30 to 50 feet over the building, is this shiny metallic disc sitting there about 30 to 50 feet wide, just hovering over the rear of the Sears building right there, that close. And that's what everybody is jumping out of their cars and pointing at. And I literally did a cartoon eye rub because I don't believe in UFOs. And I literally did a cartoon eye rub. I look back up. Sure enough, it's there. I'm like, oh my God, I got to switch religions now. I got to change religions because here the damn thing is, you can't deny it. And in the presence of all these witnesses, daylight sighting up close and personal. So I thought, well, I'll get out of my car for a little better look. And when I reached for my door handle, the UFO just barely perceptibly moved closer toward us. And as it did, the clouds rushed down from behind it, covered it up. And the second the clouds covered the UFO up, the rain was back in its former intensity instantly. Didn't start up again. It was just there in that same intensity instantly. So I'm poking on the corner of this guy, and I'm still going to get in the Sears parking lot. Well, he turns in there too. So I stay on his bumper, and I say, I don't care if I hit this guy, but the insurance will pay for it. I'm going to get this guy and corner him. I'm going to talk to him about this. So I park next to him. As I see his dome light come on, he runs off through the rain and instantly disappears. And I jump out, and the rain is hitting so hard it hurts. Ooh. And I'm shielding my eyes, and I'm running, and I run through the rain to get there to the store, and they had this little airlock inside the stairs down to the basement, then a couple of double doors that went into the store proper, and they had one of those mats there you wipe your feet on. He was just standing there with his head hung down. I remember he wore glasses. I didn't at the time. Mm-hmm. And his glasses were beaded with water. He hadn't even wiped them. And he's dripping water like he just came out of the shower. I'm dripping water like I just came out of the shower. And he didn't even know I'm there. He's just staring down at the floor. So I walked around in front of him, kind of waited for him to acknowledge my presence. He looked up and saw that I was there. And I said, excuse me, fellow, but did you just see what I just saw? And he looked at me a little bit and he said, yeah, but I damn sure ain't going to tell nobody. And he sidestepped me and walked off into the store. And you got to remember, back at the time, that was, you know, it's still been bad up until the government has admitted the truth of it now. You still got made fun of. But back then, you know, people were ready to commit you. made horrible fun of you. You could lose your job, whatever. So you didn't talk about the experiences you had for the most part.
Right.
But that was my first UFO experience. And that's when I had to say, okay, they're out there. I don't know whose they are. Don't know what they are. And we still don't. I'm convinced somebody in government does, but the general populace, general public doesn't know. And since then I've had, oh, probably 10, 15 at least more sightings, and some of them even more spectacular than that. So, yep, they're there. They're real. Our government has finally acknowledged it now, but we're still digging around for the full disclosure, the full truth, the real truth of who are they, what are they, why are they here, what do they want. And the problem we have with the UFO experience doesn't seem to be a very good one. Mm-hmm. You've got the occasional people that, oh, you know, the UFOs came to me and landed in my yard, and the little green men come out and give me wisdom and knowledge. Well, where is that wisdom and knowledge, and what practical good is it doing anybody?
Right.
You know, we haven't had anybody land or anybody transmit thoughts to somebody for something that, here's a cure for cancer, go get all the little kids out of St. Jude's, you know?
Right, exactly.
We haven't had that, but we do have abductions, mm-hmm. Which is a horrible thing to do against someone's will. We have cattle mutilations that are supposedly tied to the UFOs, and we see that continuing still, like with the Skinwalker Ranch episodes and things like that.
Yep. Yeah.
So we have this enormous power that can do these incredible things that defy all the laws of physics as we know them. We have these abduction experiences, these cattle mutilation experiences. We have the government acknowledging that they are real physical craft and that they're not ours or anybody else's on Earth. That's acknowledged now. But nobody is coming out with the real truth that we can hang our hats on of who are they, what are they, why are they here, what are their purposes, what's going on. We know they've been here forever. They show up in descriptions and in paintings from hundreds of years ago. And the spirits that I've talked to tell me that they interacted with them back hundreds of years ago, like Native American Indian spirits that I've interacted with have told me, yeah, we saw them. We interacted with them back then. They were, you know, existent even back then. So they've been here for all this time. But who and what and why? And why are they cloaked in so much secrecy? And why can't we get a real answer? Why can't we get something that that we need, can hang our hats on? And it's like the one podcast show, The Unidentified Celebrity Review, mm-hmm. they hosted a couple of the Big Phone Home, kind of named after a kind of an homage to E.T.
Yeah, yeah.
And on this Big Phone Home, they had like Lou Elizondo and all the famous names in ufology and all these other investigators and people. And they managed to score a congressman on there, Tim Burchett. And Tim acknowledged that, yes, they're real. And the whole focus of the Big Phone Home was, how can we get more information? What can we do to make a difference, put pressure on people so we can get some real information about this? And Tim said, you know, listen, we got to get out there and really get after these people in Congress and military science, everything. We've got to get after them, kick their butts, and get some answers. We have to do it. We have to take the fight to them, and we have to just not take no for an answer. And there has to be enough of a large enough effort and a continued effort that we keep that pressure on until something finally breaks. And he said, if we don't do that, it's all going to revert to business as usual. We'll be right back where we started from. So that's a congressman saying that. So that's my contention, is that, you know, we, the people, have got to exercise our power and continue to exercise our power. And, you know, people give up, throw their hands up, say, well, I tried or whatever. Well, we can't stop. We have to continue. And people say, well, if they're here and they're that powerful, they're going to do what they want to anyways. So what does it matter to me? Well, it does matter to you. Aren't you curious? Don't you want to know, you know, if they're, what their purpose is? And then we can go from there and figure out what we need to do as far as our action, interaction, whatever, our reaction. So I think it's one of the most important issues of our time, and for the government to have admitted the reality of it, and then the news media sits on their hands, doesn't follow up, doesn't keep the pressure on, doesn't do anything.
True. I think, though, as far as the news media goes, I don't think the news media is capable of treating it without throwing either something sophomoric into it or even handling it without putting something hyperbolic in it. You know, I mean, there's it's one extreme or the other. They're not capable of handling it with the amount of respect it deserves or the amount of weight it deserves. You know?
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think, you know, if you look at the media in general, I bookmarked this page that I saw on Yahoo News the other day, and the headline was something to the effect of Donald Trump has had a horrible, terrible, very bad, blah, 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 on and on and on like that day. And then when, whether you're pro Donald Trump or anti Donald Trump or don't care about Trump at all, the point I'm trying to make is that the headline was written. It sounded like somebody in elementary school writing a headline for their school newspaper, you know, na 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 boo boo type thing. I mean, it was just ridiculous. It was totally unprofessional.
Right.
It was just totally. I was like, my God, this is what the news has degenerated to. This is what we get now, is, you know, for things. And most news is opinion.
Right.
Used to, you had the facts of what happened, then you had the opinion page, the editorial page in the newspaper, and people wrote in their opinions, and the paper gave their opinion. The editor of the paper said, well, here's what I think. But you had that in a separate thing, and you got actual news for the most part.
Right.
And news, people have to understand, news is the facts of what happened without interpretation, just the facts of what happened.
Right.
And then opinion goes on top of that. Well, this is what happened. This is what I feel about it. So, you know, we have a dearth of good reporting in all media, I think. And it's just this goes back to the accountability, to a lot of the mess we need to clean up. We need to clean up the news reporting. We need to clean up the field of ufology. We got too many frauds and phonies in there. We got too many people disseminating stuff that's just ridiculous. And even among those that have been respected in the field, we're beating Roswell to death still.
Yeah.
We're beating Rendlesham Forest to death still. And what bothers me is, like, the same guys show up at the same paranormal seminars, sell the same books, and they don't have anything to use, the same thing to say. Now, look, the UFOs are doing stuff daily all around us. Mm-hmm. And it's just like the paranormal realm is all around us, and things are happening to people all the time, right now, as we're sitting here speaking.
Sure.
Oh, so why doesn't somebody with funding put together a news crew to go out and say, hey, let's find out what's going on today, right now, and let's talk about that, and let's get good pictures of it, and let's get good evidence of it, let's get good audio of it, and try and figure out what's going on and piece some of this together. Why do we keep beating the same horses to death over and over and over again when there's plenty of new stuff out there? Every time I turn on something on TV that's a brand new show about the paranormal or about UFOs and get all excited, here comes Rendlesham Forest. Here comes Roswell. Here comes, well, this lady saw this back in 1953. And it's like, dude, there's people seeing things today, right now. Let's go interview them, talk to them, get their stories, and see what you can get on film and see what might happen and so on and so forth. So I'm confounded by the lack of motivation to get out of ancient history, so to speak, and to document what's going on right now. I just don't understand the reasoning behind it. And you don't negate those cases. Sure, they're powerful cases, but, you know, what's going on right now?
You know,
just like, I went to my asthma doctor.
Yep.
And we just moved, and so I had to get new doctors for everything. So I went to my new asthma doctor, and he asked what I did, and I told him I'm a psychic, and I expected the big eye roll, and instead I got a story about UFOs he had seen.
Really?
Out in the forest here, you know? So it's like, this stuff is going on all the time, and there's all kinds of people having experiences. You know, why doesn't somebody with funding put a little crew together on a shoestring and get a good camera and get some good investigators and go out there and not just capture it, but see what you can infer and interact with and so on and so forth, see what information you might possibly get. So it just boggles my mind that that's not going on. I just don't understand why.
We do a Supernatural News on Wednesdays, and mind you, we do throw a little bit of humor in there. But every single week, John, there are at least 2 to 3 credible UFO sightings, and not just Sally saw something over her house. We're talking major, credible UFO sightings that are being reported in mainstream media.
Yeah.
And not, I'm not talking like, a questionable website.
Right.
I'm talking like a credible news source comes out and says, you know, this is an unidentified craft. So, you know, it's interesting that, the activity is ramping up.
And
it's been ramped up now for probably a good 3 to 4 years. And it's continuing to ramp up.
It is. Yeah, absolutely. And my beef with all of that, again, is going back to these credible occurrences are happening. And why doesn't somebody with the facility, the capability, because we all know, look, it takes gas money and lodging and food and camera gear and everything else, and all that's expensive, and the expenses. I understand that from shooting the TV pilot and seeing the expenses that went on there from doing that. But, you know, there's an awful lot of people in this country with awfully deep pockets. And if they have an interest in this at all, you know, they could fund a small crew and get to these people that this stuff is happening to on a daily basis right now, and investigate it and see where it goes, and do some, have some kind of a push to either bring it forcefully into the mainstream media in such a way that they can't ignore it any longer, or to fund something that they can televise themselves or start their own channel somehow or something of that nature and present that information there in a credible way.
Well, let me ask you this, because it seems to me like these sightings are in random locations. And I'll throw this right back on you. To you, does it seem like, have you had contact with an alien type mind where you could say you can read that type of mind, or you can get a grasp on this type of mind where you could predict where these sightings would happen?
I haven't, but I know that interactions do happen, and I'll give you an incident why. I was sitting out one night, and at the house we lived at before we moved, we had this courtyard, and with this clear view of the sky, and I saw this orange orb coming along, and I thought maybe it was the landing lights of a plane or whatever, but as I looked at it, I began to realize there was no sound, no motor noise, nothing. It was just silently going through the sky, and it got closer, and I was like, my God, that's a UFO. And as I'm watching it, it got right overhead, right in front of me and overhead, and I'm looking at it, and I stood up, and I verbally said, and I psychically also said, if you can hear me, stop right now and back up, reverse course. And son of a gun, the damn thing stopped immediately, slightly reversed course in the sky while I'm standing there slack-jawed like a yokel staring up at this thing. And then it shot off from this low level up to where the around the level of where the large airliners fly in the sky. It sat there a little bit, and then in a split second's time shot up to the stars, kind of wandered around there among the stars a little bit, and then shot off out of sight into the universe. And when it shot from those levels, when it went from the height of where the aircraft fly, which is, what, 30, 35,000, 40,000 feet, up into the stars, it did that in a second's time. No noise, no sound, nothing.
Wow.
And so obviously there is, and I was on another interview where the interviewer asked me, he said, you know, he said, there are other people that report these interactions or reactions from these craft. And he said, what is it that they could respond to what you sent out instantaneously, but then no further communication, just kind of like a, yeah, look at us, look what we can do, and take off. And I said, yeah, that's basically kind of how it felt, was, you know, yeah, we hear you, but look at here what we can do.
Yeah.
And so, again, going back to trying to get some type of reputable, reliable, quality contact with these beings that you can hang your hat on seems to be very difficult to do. I have attempted it and haven't been successful at it.
That's not the first time I've ever heard that either. I've heard that from other experiencers, that they, they've looked up just by thought, have projected thought up to it, and it's done the exact same thing they thought, and then they've walked away.
Right. Right. Yeah.
It's very strange. Very strange.
It is very strange. And it's something that, you know, look, as close a relationship as a psychic and a paranormal investigator as I have with the other side, there is still so many questions I have unanswered there. And there's still so many mysteries there. And for all the wonderful things I've experienced and been able to help other people experience and change their lives for the better with my gift and so on and so forth, and the things I've been able to teach them, the other side still plays peekaboo with us an awful lot. And, you know, that I don't know why. And it's very frustrating, but we keep going. We keep trying.
Do you think that maybe, and we'll start to wrap it up with this, John, do you think that maybe there are just some things that are just revealed to us when we pass that all will be revealed at that time?
I hope so. And I think maybe so. I think there's some things that we just don't get to be privy to now for whatever reason. And as far as everything being revealed on the other side, from what I'm able to ascertain from the guides, the angels and everything that have communicated with me, what knowledge they've been able to give to me, and from deceased loved ones on the other side, so on. Apparently, there's still kind of like a growth and a learning process there. It isn't this, oh, so that's how it is. There isn't this all-enlightening revelation when we get there. Apparently, there's like an adaptive process when we cross over, and then a learning process and kind of a, you know, familiarization. And then apparently people get to pick out what they're going to study, if you will, or what they're going to learn, or how they advance, or, you know, what's it like over here? What can I do? How can I help myself and others now? Is there some way I can communicate back with my loved ones? How do you do that? Mm-hmm. And those types of things. So I don't think we get all the answers right when we cross over.
All right.
Great if we did.
It would be. Is there one thing about death that would shock us? I mean, we've heard a lot of the same stuff, I guess, from different people who communicate with people from the other side, psychics, if you will. Is there one thing that you've learned that would kind of set us back in our seat and go, wow, I never expect that about death?
I think the thing for me that made the biggest impact on me was I had a spirit communicate to me what the act of dying is like and what crossing over is like. Because you hear a lot of people say, oh, well, somebody's earthbound, or they need to cross into the light, or they don't know they're dead. And so this spirit came to me and gave me this vision, and the spirit likened the death process to driving a car, with the car being your physical body. Now, if you're driving your car and you run out of gas, you're aware that you're in the car and you're aware that the car is running out of gas. You pull over and stop and say, well, I got to get out and see if I can get some help. And you get out of your car and you're aware that you're out of your car. You're not in your car any longer. And you know that. Mm-hmm. Now, you may be in an unfamiliar neighborhood and say, well, where do I find a gas station or whatever? Sure. But you know you're out of the car. And they were giving that as an analogy to me to tell me that, hey, when you die, you leave that physical body and you're aware that you're out of your physical body. You've left the car. You know you're out of the car. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, you know you're dead. You know you're on the other side. And from everything that we've been able to glean, we do believe that there are guardian angels, loved ones, whatever, that come and greet us, help us to cross over and to help us to begin that process and give us an awareness of where we are and how things work, so to speak. But I think that was the biggest revelation for me, was for somebody in the knowing the spirit realm to say, hey, you know, if you're there, you're there. You know you're dead. There's none of this. Somebody's hanging around. They don't know they're dead and go to the light. Hey, look, you're there. And you know you're there. You know you're dead. You're out of the car and you know it. So I think for me, that was a big revelation about the death process itself.
So clarify this for all of us then, John. When you're on an investigation, and you're, let's say, like at a prison, abandoned prison, and you're walking around and, no, you know what, well, let me change the scenario. Let's go to the Queen Mary, for example, and you've got Jackie, the ghost who's on the Queen Mary, who's been sent to the light many times by many different investigators.
Right.
Yeah, Jackie is still on the Queen Mary, surprisingly.
Exactly.
Clarify for our audience, if you will, Can a live human being such as you or I send a spirit to the light and clear a ghost?
Good Lord, no. That's impossible. For one thing, you're dealing with an entity that still has volition, will, emotion, thought, purpose, design. So it would be like me telling you, Tim, turn around and grab that buckle over there and show it to me. And you're going, no, I'm not going to do that. So I don't exercise control over you. We don't exercise control over the spiritual realm in that manner. I get tickled at people that, like you say, she's been sent to the light a jillion times. She's still there. I get tickled at people that so-called psychics or priests or anybody that comes in. I'm going to get rid of this ghost. I'm going to close this portal. I'm going to stop this activity. Not only do they not, most of the time it exacerbates it and makes it worse because we don't have that power over that realm. We like to think we do, but we don't. And, you know, I think that there are people on the other side, both human, that have crossed over. And I think that there are invisible entities over there that have good senses of humor. And I think they like to jack with us a little bit, you know, and I think they may sometimes spin a yarn that isn't quite exactly so, just because I know they've got somebody gullible or whatever. And so, no, I don't think anybody crosses anyone over, sends anyone to the light or closes a portal or exercises a ghost or whatever. I have personally known of many people that have made that claim, both in the religious and the spiritual realms, including some very well-known people. And it's never panned out. It's never worked. Most of the time, the activity either immediately comes back or doesn't stop to begin with and actually worsens. So we don't have that control over that realm that we believe we do.
All right. Our guest, John Russell, he has two books out there that you're going to want to check out, Riding with Ghosts, Angels, and the Spirits of the Dead, and A Knock in the Attic, True Ghost Stories, and Other Spine-Chilling Paranormal Adventures. We have a link in the description of this program. By all means, click it and pick up both books. They're both intriguing reads at that. John, I want to thank you very much for being with us today. And we haven't even really talked about any of your investigations, so we'll have to do this again sometime soon, my friend.
We'll have to do it again. Absolutely. Tim, it's been a pleasure to be here. I appreciate it. I look forward to coming back. We haven't scratched the surface. I can tell you of so many experiences and things and my investigations and things, but just some of the paranormal experiences I've had are just incredible. And a lot of those I write about in both Scratches the Surface. It's like I said, I've had well over 1,000. They continue to occur on a daily basis for me. So it's an exciting life. And I think the people that read the books, all the feedback that I'm getting from everyone has been really terrific, and they've really enjoyed them. And I think some of the best feedback that I've gotten is that people have said, you know, now I'm not afraid of this realm anymore. I'm not afraid to open up my eyes and perceive what may be around me and interact with that. So I think that's one of the best things I've been able to accomplish with my books is take some of that fear of the paranormal away for people, because there's so many misconceptions and so many fears about things out there. And if I can help alleviate that and give somebody a better spiritual walk, that's the best thing.
That's awesome. And definitely. And again, and that's a key phrase there, John. If you do have a bit of a fear of what's on the other side, or a bit of a fear of this thing we call the paranormal, I would encourage you to go out there and get both books, Riding with Ghosts, Angels, and Spirits of the Dead, and A Knock in the Attic, True Ghost Stories, and Other Spine-Chilling Paranormal Adventures. Again, the link is in the description of this program. Go and pick up both of those books. John, thank you very much for being with us today.
Tim, thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you to all the listeners.
All right. Thank you, my friend. And folks, I want to thank you very much for joining us for another great week here on Darkness Radio. Be safe, be kind to one another, and by all means, look out for one another this weekend. Have a good weekend. Be safe. And we will see you back right here next week for the best in paranormal podcasting. This is Darkness Radio.
MODO.US for the best free play social casino experience wherever you are. Modo offers a huge selection of Vegas-style games with free spins, exciting promotions, and always generous jackpots. You can waste your time with the others, or you can win at Modo. Register today at MODO.US for your free welcome bonus.
Modo is a social casino. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Conditions apply. See website for details.
MODO.US. MODO.US.
Visit MODO.US for the best free play social casino experience wherever you are. Modo offers a huge selection of Vegas-style games and now introducing live blackjack, roulette, and casino hold'em. These are so much fun. Modo always has generous jackpots, free spins, and exciting promotions. Register today at MODO.US for your free welcome bonus.
Modo is a social casino. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Conditions apply. See website for details.
MODO.US.
Let's check in with golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
Whoa, John, what are you playing?
I only spent on Modo, America's social casino. You know, I've won a couple of majors. And on Modo, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Modo Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. That's Daly. Modo Casino, hands down, has the best VIP experience. Take it from one high roller to another. If you're ready to go for the greens with me, grip it and spin it on Modo Casino.
Modo Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Modo.us for more details.
Modo.us.
Visit MODO.US for the best free play social casino experience wherever you are. Modo offers a huge selection of Vegas-style games and now introducing live blackjack, roulette, and casino hold'em. These are so much fun. Modo always has generous jackpots, free spins, and exciting promotions. Register today at MODO.US for your free welcome bonus.
Modo is a social casino. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Conditions apply. See website for details.
Modo.us.
It's time to play big on Modo Social Casino, America's hottest free-to-play social casino experience. Modo.us has live casino games. It's time! Play big, win bigger on Modo.us today.
Modo is a social casino, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Visit Modo.us for more details.
It's time!
Modo.us.
Let's check in with golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
Whoa, John, what are you playing?
I only spent on Modo, America's social casino. You know, I've won a couple of majors. And on Modo, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Modo Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. That's Daly. Modo Casino, hands down, has the best VIP experience. Take it from one high roller to another. If you're ready to go for the greens with me, grip it and spin it on Modo Casino.
Modo Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Modo.us for more details.
Modo.us.
Visit MODO.US for the best free play social casino experience wherever you are. Modo offers a huge selection of Vegas-style games and now introducing live blackjack, roulette, and casino hold'em. These are so much fun. Modo always has generous jackpots, free spins, and exciting promotions. Register today at MODO.US for your free welcome bonus.
Modo is a social casino. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Conditions apply. See website for details.
Modo.us.
Let's check in with golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
Whoa, John, what are you playing?
I only spent on Modo, America's social casino. You know, I've won a couple of majors. And on Modo, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Modo Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. That's Daly. Modo Casino, hands down, has the best VIP experience. Take it from one high roller to another. If you're ready to go for the greens with me, grip it and spin it on Modo Casino.
Modo Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Modo.us for more details.
Modo.us.
Visit MODO.US for the best free play social casino experience wherever you are. Modo offers a huge selection of Vegas-style games and now introducing live blackjack, roulette, and casino hold'em. These are so much fun. Modo always has generous jackpots, free spins, and exciting promotions. Register today at MODO.US for your free welcome bonus.
Modo is a social casino. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Conditions apply. See website for details.
Modo.us.
Save big money and start your spring project with help from Menards. We offer a huge selection of Bonnie plants, veggies, and herbs to plant at home and grow yourself. Right now, all 4.5-inch Bonnie plants are on sale through May 18th. Head to the Menards Garden Center to get your garden growing and check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money.